Hello there. Today is Monday, October 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, top senators are asking the White House for answers on what U.S. troops are doing in Niger. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaks in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
We believe this will, in some ways, counter some of the unproductive influences of Iran inside of Iraq.
The Trump administration's third attempt at a travel ban is again on hold. Also ahead, why Snapchat is the new favorite social media app with teens. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis went to Capitol Hill Friday to meet with Senator John McCain after the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee threatened to issue a subpoena for information about the deaths of four U.S. soldiers killed in Niger earlier this month. After meeting privately with McCain in his office, Mattis promised to keep better lines of communication with Congress.
And the loss of our troops is under investigation. We in the Department of Defense like to know what we're talking about before we talk. And so we do not have all the accurate information yet. We will release it as rapidly as we get it.
On Sunday, several senators said that the White House has not been forthcoming with details about the military's presence in Niger following the deaths of those soldiers and said they want more answers. The attack earlier this month, which U.S. officials suspect was carried out by a local Islamic State affiliate, has thrown a spotlight on the mission in Niger, where there are close to 1,000 U.S. troops. On NBC's Meet the Press, anchor Chuck Todd spoke with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, asking just what precisely U.S. troops are doing in the West African nation.
On October 4th, we were told after this happened that it was they were there to do counterterrorism training. October 5th, it was a reconnaissance patrol. On October 6th, we were told they were there to establish relations with local leaders. John Kelly, on October 19th, at just 3 days ago, basically said, I actually know a lot more than I'm letting on, but I'm not going to tell you. John McCain had to threaten a subpoena just to get Jim Mattis, Secretary of Defense, to come down and talk to you guys even briefly. What more can you tell us about why we were there and what we were doing?
Well, they're going to brief us next week as to why they were there and what they were doing. I got a little insight of why they were there and what they were doing. I can say this to the families. They were there to defend America. They were there to help allies. They were there to prevent another platform to attack America and our allies. Senator McCain is frustrated, rightly so. We don't know exactly where we're at in the world militarily and what we're doing. So John McCain is going to try to create a new system to make sure that we can answer the question, why were we there? We'll know how many soldiers are there. And if somebody gets killed there, that we won't find out about it in the paper. And John McCain and I think General Mattis are going to come up with a new process, I hope.
All right, you used some alarming words when you said we don't want the next 9/11 to come from Niger.
Yeah.
So you're making the case then that this is all part of the same war that you guys authorized in 2002 and in 2001, that the same war that you authorized that was, we thought, about Afghanistan, then it turned to Iraq, then it's been used for Libya, for Syria, and now we're in another continent.
Yeah, I don't think the forces inside of Niger, the ISIL-affiliated forces, have the capability to attack the United States. But what happened in Afghanistan is that you had a government that fell, replaced by a radical organization, the Taliban, a government that invited international terrorists in and to be their welcome guest. So what I worry about Africa, it becomes the new platform for people to come to. The ungoverned spaces of Africa is where the terrorists will come after you defeat them in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a generational struggle. If you don't think it's a generational struggle, you don't understand the war. If you think it's limited to the Mideast, you don't understand the theology. It is spreading throughout the world, particularly Africa. And if you think it's going to be done in a short period of time, or if you can't, if you take off means of how you fight this war, if there's an authorization to use force tomorrow that limited the war based on time, geography, and means, I would vote against it because the war is now morphing. It's going to places that we haven't heard of before to the American people. We're going to follow the terrorists wherever they go. We're going to use whatever means we need to with partners to destroy them. And whatever time it takes. And most people are not ready for that, but I am.
That's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking to NBC's Chuck Todd. A federal judge dealt another blow last week to the Trump administration's third attempt at issuing a travel ban. The latest order would have barred to various degrees travelers from Chad, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. The temporary restraining order does not interfere with restrictions the new order has on North Korea and Venezuela, which were also included this time. The Justice Department calling the ruling incorrect and says it will appeal and ultimately prevail. In his opinion, the judge said the new travel order suffers from precisely the same maladies as its predecessor. It lacks sufficient findings that the entry of more than 150 million nationals from six specified countries would be detrimental to the United States. The White House argues that its restrictions are vital to national security. Joining us now to explain this latest setback for the administration is San Francisco appellate lawyer Anna Rose Matheson. What exactly happened this time?
Trump issued a third version of the travel ban after the Supreme Court was supposed to review the second version. So this new version was broader than the first and applied to two countries that aren't majority Muslim. So the first two travel bans only applied to countries that were majority Muslim. This one applied also to North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela. So the Trump administration said, well, we're clearly not discriminating here because North Korea is obviously not Muslim, so this should be fine. It also has some more detailed findings, but two judges, one in Hawaii and one in Maryland, have now issued orders barring this new travel ban from taking effect.
Where does it go from here? Does this mean that it's off again?
It is off. It was supposed to take, the third version of the ban was supposed to take effect, but there's now two orders barring it from taking effect until, well, so the Hawaii one, they didn't actually challenge the ban as to travelers from North Korea and Venezuela, but there's very few of those people who come to the country anyway. So it has, for all intents and purposes, yes, travel ban is not going to take effect. Where we go from here is the next step is review in the Court of Appeals once again. So there will be an appeal to the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit from these two district court opinions. Based on the prior decisions, both those courts will likely rule against the ban, rule against the Trump administration, and then the administration will likely appeal to the Supreme Court or seek review, and there's a very good chance the Supreme Court will grant review and set it for argument again. And the Supreme Court might, based on its prior orders, might lift the stay, that is, allow the ban to go into effect as to travelers who don't have a bona fide connection to the United States. That is, in the earlier litigation, the district courts and the two courts of appeals had both issued broad injunctions stopping the travel ban from taking effect. The Supreme Court said, well, that's fine as to travelers who have a bona fide or a close connection to the United States, that is, the parents or siblings of someone who's in the United States legally. But it's fine to enforce until we decide whether the ban is valid or not under the statutes, under the Constitution. The Trump administration can continue to enforce the ban as to travelers who have no bona fide connection to the United States. So chances are the Supreme Court will say something similar again if the Trump administration again asks the Supreme Court to lift part of the stay on the ban. So they'll be able to enforce at least part of the ban as to travelers without a connection until the Supreme Court once again grants review and decides the actual underlying questions that haven't reached it yet.
What was the reasoning for the latest blocking of the travel ban?
The judges basically said this ban has pretty much all the same problems as the earlier bans that the judges blocked. So the judge in Hawaii focused a lot on the statutory issue. That is, just like the Ninth Circuit did in the prior decision, the judge in Hawaii said the government hasn't shown that the president is actually properly exercising the authority that Congress has given. So Congress has total control over immigration matters. But Congress has given the president some authority, but the president can't just make decisions without any good basis. He has to really explain and have a solid, rational basis for these decisions. And so the judge in Hawaii focused on how The government really hadn't done that here. And the judge in Maryland focused more, just like in the previous round of litigation, why this ban is really, even though it throws in these two other countries, even though it includes people from North Korea and some government officials from Venezuela, is really just a Muslim ban in disguise. Looks at the recent statements from Trump that reinforce that. Then the judge in Hawaii touched on this too. Looks at the recent statements from Trump that suggest what he has been doing all along is trying to ban the really dangerous people from Muslim countries and do that with a wholesale Muslim ban and just essentially threw in a few more countries where no one really comes here and no one is going to get too worked up about banning people from North Korea. So threw those in essentially to try to disguise it.
That's San Francisco appellate lawyer Anna Rose Mathiesen. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump defends his frequent Twitter bickering with U.S. officials. Rex Tillerson promotes closer Iraq-Saudi links. A Yemeni journalist is denied entry to the U.S. to receive an award. And President Trump says he will okay the release of the final batch of JFK assassination files. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson is en route to South Asia. Speaking from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia on Sunday, he promoted improving ties between Saudi Arabia and Iraq as a way to counter Iran's growing military assertiveness in the region. Tillerson, participating in the initial meeting of the Saudi Arabia-Iraq Coordination Committee in Riyadh, told Saudi King Salman and Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi that their improving links showed great potential. And he cited the August reopening of a major border crossing between the two countries and the resumption of direct flights, between Baghdad and Riyadh.
And we do seek to support, as does the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, a whole of Iraq, and that Iraq is secure and stable, and as I indicated, has the ability to stand on its own. We believe this will, in some ways, counter some of the unproductive influences of Iran inside of Iraq. Certainly, Iranian militias that are in Iraq, now that the fight against Daesh and ISIS is coming to a close, those militias need to go home. Any foreign fighters in Iraq need to go home and allow the Iraqi people to regain control of areas that had been overtaken by ISIS and Daesh that have now been liberated, allow the Iraqi people to rebuild their lives with the help of their neighbors.
The visit includes a stop in India, whose relationship with the U.S. has evolved into what is effectively an alliance, much to the suspicion of New Delhi's neighbors. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Indiana University professor Hussein Banai what he thinks of Tillerson's latest comments.
Well, I think it's meant to basically push back on what has been, from Washington's perspective, a decade-long expansion of Iranian power in Iraqi politics, which they deem to be naturally part of the Arabian kind of milieu, and the kind of the Iranians, the Persian influence there needs to resist it. And this is something that obviously the Saudis and many of the other Gulf Cooperation Council countries have been lobbying Washington on, going back to the latter part of the Bush administration, throughout the Obama administration, and now in the Trump administration, they finally have found a willing partner to actually support that move. So I think this is very much something from the very beginning of the administration has been consistently impressed on the Iranians by Tillerson, and now they seem to be taking concrete steps to actually formalize it or institutionalize it in the form of this coordination committee between Saudi Arabia and Iraq.
Given the adversarial relationship between Riyadh and Tehran, and given the backdrop of the U.S. decision to decertify Iran vis-a-vis the International Nuclear Agreement, do you see a new U.S. policy in the region emerging?
I think it's a new U.S. tactic, less a policy or strategy, in that the tactic is to basically make the Saudis and other wealthy Arab countries become bigger players in countries that have been neglected from Washington's perspective in terms of their influence. So I think the tactic here is to get basically the Saudis a bigger stake in Iraqi politics and that way to balance the Iranian influence in Iraq somewhat. But it remains to be seen whether actually that will bear any fruit, since Iraqi Shiites have greater historical affinity with Iran. And already in the last 10 years or so, Iran has done much to basically fortify its influence, not just through brute military or militia-backed groups, but rather through economic investments that has many of these Shia-dominated areas beholden to Iranian commercial interests. So until Saudi Arabia takes steps to basically replace Iran as a major trade and commercial partner of Iraq, I think this tactic may very well end up being just that, a kind of a formal posturing on the part of the Saudis and the United States.
Can Saudi Arabia be an ally of Iraq?
It could, certainly. It is certainly an ally of Iraqi Sunnis. Whether it can rise above that sectarian divide is the question. And here, I think where the Saudis have to basically put their money where their rhetoric has been all along. And we'll see if that happens. Then I think Saudi Arabia absolutely could play a role in becoming a partner for Iraq.
Israel has complained about it for years, but how do you view Iran's influence in the region, particularly in Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere?
It's complicated. I think it is usually assumed that Iran has had this hegemony in the region. I think it's far from that. I think Iranian militias and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards have spread their influence, have backed certain groups. They have certainly planted their flag in countries where they didn't have any representation before. But it's not at all the case that they control the everyday politics of these countries. Iran has influence in terms of pushing back against what it regards to be a highly sectarian a strategy on the part of Arab countries to basically alienate Shiites in throughout the Arab world. That has been their goal, to basically support those groups. But beyond that, Iran really doesn't really control the politics of these countries. And it is there to basically ensure that its interests and its kind of cultural and economic ties to Shia communities are guarded first and foremost, but nothing more than that.
Tillerson denounced Iran's what he called malign behavior, urged nations of the region and elsewhere, especially Europe, to join the administration to halt business activities with Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Will they heed that advice?
Doubtful that the Europeans would change their renewed policy towards Iran after the nuclear deal, which is to basically open economic ties with Iran and have European companies operate out of Iran. But when it comes to pushing back on Iran's activities in the region, this is something that actually there's been a united front with the Europeans and the Americans since the Iraq's invasion in 2003 by the United States and Great Britain. Change here is really steps being taken to tip the balance towards the Sunni Arab countries in the region again. And on this, I don't think the European countries would be that quick to join that call, only because they have watched with a great deal of a reservation how sectarian multiple wars in the region have become because of the influence of Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries that have deliberately turned these conflicts from what were originally crises of political legitimacy to highly sectarian conflicts. And on that, they do not want to kind of open that Pandora's box again or push against Iran in that way.
That's Victor Beatties speaking with Indiana University Professor Hussein Banai. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Pollution accounts for more deaths every year than any illness. That is the headline from a new report published in the medical journal The Lancet. Part of the response to this massive number involves treating pollution like a health issue instead of just an environmental problem. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
The key takeaway from the report is that pollution damages human health, not just the environment.
It kills more people than war, than hunger, than malaria or AIDS or tuberculosis. All of these pale in comparison.
The other takeaway is that the mortality rate is primarily affecting people who have the most trouble getting help.
In 2015, pollution-related diseases accounted for 9.6 million deaths. 92% of that burden is in low and middle-income countries. That is big for us. It's big in terms of the distribution of the problem. To put it in plain speak, the distribution is unfair.
The researchers say our brains are making pollution harder to fight.
Human beings are wired to respond to immediate threats. Infectious diseases like Zika, like dengue, that make people quickly and obviously sick, really get the public attention. By contrast, non-communicable diseases, chronic diseases that are caused by pollution, learning disabilities, cancer, chronic lung disease, take years to play out. The connection between cause and effect is not visible, and people put it in the back of their mind.
So the report tries to break down the problem into smaller parts.
There's air pollution, water pollution, soil, or workplace issues. Within each of those categories, there tend to be the same kind of problems that show up again and again and again. And this is how we should look at pollution.
Like the pervasive air pollution in India and China.
India has become vastly more dangerous over the last 20 years because of the air pollution. Dangerous in a way that we've really never seen on the planet.
In other places, it's ground pollution by lead and hazardous waste that sticks around for years.
Soil pollution toxicants don't break down. They stay in the soil and can continue to poison people for generations.
Everyone involved says things are getting better, but also that a lot of damage has already been done.
No matter where you go, parents never want to see their kids getting poisoned. A kid who has brain damage from lead poisoning is never going to have the full potential of his life. And it can't be fixed, but it can be prevented, and the next kid can be protected.
The Lancet report urges nations to set specific 5-year, 10-year, and beyond targets to make the problem feel more manageable. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what you got?
Well, Lori, we know that President Trump loves social media. He's on Twitter constantly. Well, now he's saying that he would not have become president without social media. Something maybe we would have figured out by now because he's tweeted so much, but he's coming out and saying this firsthand. In an interview with Fox News, he's saying that his ability to reach people through social media is why he became so popular and subsequently why he became president. He cites the fact that he has over 125 million followers between Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and says that without that direct connection with the public, he would not be able to have become so popular and reach so many people and become the president that he is. And he is certainly the president right now. So social media, I guess, had to do something with that.
All right, Andrew, we always appreciate your perspective. Thanks for chiming in on a Sunday. You can follow him on Twitter at, or Monday, I should say. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And speaking of social media, American teens have crowned a new king of social media. According to a recent poll, Snapchat is the most popular app for teens, toppling even Facebook for their neck-bending attention. Arash Arabasadi reports from Washington.
If you've got one of the world's 6 billion or so smartphones, you're likely using some form of social media like Facebook or Instagram. But if you're an American teenager, your social media of choice is probably Snapchat. It's an app for sharing pictures and videos that live online, sometimes for only a few seconds and up to 24 hours before the app deletes them. According to a new poll by investment banking firm Piper Jaffray, Snapchat is what most American teens are using. Piper Jaffray declined to comment for this story, but VOA spoke with social media expert and American University professor Steph Woods.
It's easy, it's accessible, it's quick, and it's secret, or at least private as much as things can be via social media. It's an app that typically isn't being used by their parents, so they have an element of autonomy.
Despite its popularity, according to MarketRealist.com, Snapchat's growth is actually slowing. But with a $500 million investment from NBC Universal, the media giant is betting big that by introducing original content, it can retain and earn new users in Snapchat's 18 to 24-year-old demographic. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has announced it will withdraw from UNESCO at the end of 2018. UNESCO is the Paris-based UN body whose mission is to coordinate international cooperation in education, science, culture, and communication. A well-known part of its job is to help protect the world's important cultural and natural heritage sites through the World Heritage Program. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said the decision to withdraw from UNESCO came after a long and deliberative process. The decision was based on a number of concerns. The United States is in arrears to UNESCO in the amount of almost $550 million. That's because, under federal legislation passed in the 1990s, the United States is required to stop sending funds to any UN agency that grants Palestinians recognition as a full member state. The fact is, such a move disregards the necessity for negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis that will result in a Palestinian state making a real difference in the lives of both peoples. In 2011, UNESCO made such a move, and the United States, as legally required, cut off its funding to the organization. A second concern governing the U.S. decision to withdraw is the increasing politicization, including anti-Israel bias at UNESCO. In July, for example, as the U.S. mission to the United Nations noted, UNESCO made its latest politically biased decision, designating the old city of Hebron and the Tomb of the Patriarchs as part of Palestinian territory. Such an action is an outrageous attempt to separate Israel and the Jews from their history of thousands of years. Finally, spokesperson Nauert cited the need for fundamental reform at UNESCO, as President Donald Trump has called for across the United Nations. She added, however, that the United States wants to remain engaged with UNESCO and will seek to become a non-member observer state in order to contribute U.S. views, perspectives, and expertise on some of the important issues undertaken by the organization. The decision to withdraw will also not alter U.S. policy supporting international cooperation in educational, scientific, cultural communication, and information activities where there are benefits to the United States.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.